This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, if you walk into a grocery store, you go to the dairy section, you are going to see Chobani. It's certainly a mainstay of yogurt here in the United States. The company launched back in 2007 and in recent years has been branching out beyond traditional Greek yogurt. Let's get to Peter McGinnis. He's president and chief operating officer at Chobani. He joins us on the phone from New York City. Peter, it's good to talk to you again. How you doing?
Hey, Tim. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are things going at Chobani? How has the pandemic been? What was the last year like for you?
Well, the pandemic's been tough for everybody in all businesses, but I'm proud of how we performed. We set out very early, Tim, very, very early on, to take care of our employees, keep them safe and supported. Safe was the first thing, and supported really was parallel and concurrent, and supported was childcare subsidies and special bonuses and time off to get vaccinated. And it really created a healthy, happy, productive workforce. And so we didn't close a single day. We operated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week throughout the entire pandemic because the demand was there. So the plants, the factories ran really well, long and hard. And it was an investment. It wasn't an expense to take care of our employees like that because they're healthier and happier, more productive, and wanted to come to work.
It's really remarkable to hear because over the last year, we've heard of some devastating stories from food processing plants throughout the United States where coronavirus outbreaks took the lives of so many employees. But you put measures in place early at the company, and as a result, there were no coronavirus outbreaks in your plant here in New York and South Edmonton, and neither in the one in Twin Falls, Idaho as well.
Correct. There was community spread.
Right.
But there was no plant outbreak or spread, and that was critical. And we jumped on this in mid-March, Tim, when it was unpopular, to be honest. I mean, let's have a frank conversation here. It was considered a downstate issue, if you go way back a year ago, March, and there was no cases upstate New York. There were no cases in Idaho, and we jumped on masks when it was still confusing. Are masks good, bad, indifferent? Remember all that confusion? And we mandated masks, and we were able to get equipment, ton of PPE equipment, and we cleaned every 2 hours in the factories, because remember back then they thought it was really spreadable on surfaces. And we were able to get temperature equipment when you couldn't find it. And this was all done second week of March. And it was interesting because was it wildly popular initially? No, but our job as a company, your primary job, whether I'm president or CEO or the executive leadership team or as a company, is to keep your employees safe and also keep the company operating.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about
even that there was surge demand.
Well, I want to talk about that surge in demand because you mentioned that you continued operating 24/7 because the demand was there. Even thinking back to last March, last April, when so many companies were struggling with supply chain issues, how were you able to keep things going?
Again, very proud of the team. Our sourcing team leaned in on pre-ordering milk, cultures, fruit, cups, foils, all up and down the supply chain. And we have great partnerships throughout our supply chain. And we were able to secure and procure what we needed. And so we had no interruption on the supply chain side of things. So in terms of the plants running 24/7 and us having enough raw material, we powered through it. and even powered through the height of the pantry loading, which was third week of March, you know, a year ago March, and fourth week of March. And so proud of that. Not only did we do that, Tim, we launched three new categories. We launched oat milk, creamers, and coffee, RTD coffee, in the pandemic. So three new platforms, and we launched 50 new line extensions throughout all of this. So we were able to innovate on top of just operating the base business effectively.
How are those platforms doing? How is the oat milk doing? How are the new products doing?
It's great. I mean, within a year, we became number two oat milk in U.S. food, close to over a 20 share, which is just phenomenal. We're really happy, and that's really the strength of the brand. It's branded Chobani. Chobani stands for trust and quality, and so we have a master brand, not a house of brands. A lot of CPG companies have all these sub brands. We are Chobani, so it's Chobani Greek yogurt, Chobani oat milk, Chobani coffee creamer. And so when you break into these categories, we get quick trial, and we scale quick because the brand is known, trusted, loved. And then the food is great, so we have high repeat. So the oat milk performance has been wild. We're really happy with it, and we continue to gain distribution as we speak. And so I'd say we're just in the beginning, but we're over a 20 share already. Coffee creamer, close to a 20 share. And, you know, in U.S. food, overtook Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts in the creamer segment.
Wow.
And then RTD coffee has only been out for a few months.
Peter, Chobani was started back in 2007, and there have been a handful of changes in how the company has been structured over the last few years. I know your role has changed significantly over the last few years, going from a marketing role to the chief operating officer role. Talk to me about how you're thinking about the future of Chobani. The Wall Street Journal reporting earlier this year that you guys are eyeing an IPO this year with a valuation between $7 and $10 billion.
Yeah, Tim, so I can't talk about an IPO today on this beautiful sunny Friday. but look, I think we're going to continue doing what we do. We disrupt and we challenge the status quo. And I think that goes back to Hamdi's really original vision and philosophy. He came to this country from Turkey. He looked at the food system and the food industry. He saw a lot of exclusive food in specialty stores that was high quality, but high priced. And so that notion of democratizing better options and better food for more people, and good food is a right, not a privilege, really is what keeps us going every day. And so that's why we've built factories over the last several years. We've built critical disciplines, from in-housing our entire marketing department and advertising and design to our sales functions to our retail execution team. All of that is now in-house. We've built a plant within a plant in Idaho to do creamers and RTD coffee and oat milk because we wanted to disrupt those categories and elevate them. And so we're going to continue doing what we're doing, and that is providing better options for more people in many categories, because the brand, not only is it strong, it can stretch.
What are those other categories, Peter, that you're eyeing?
Right now, we'll stick with the four. Because a year ago we were in one category. Today we're in four, and we have more work to do. And so we're going to focus on maximizing these four, but it won't end there, Tim. And then we're also going into new channels. You know, we're deeper in drug and convenience. We're deeper into food service mm-hmm. now, particularly with our oat milk barista. Hey. So you're seeing us at more cafes. We went south of the border into Mexico, which is a huge market. And we're going to exponentially grow in Mexico. We went north of the border into Canada with all of our plant-based options as well.
How do you guys think about grocery delivery? Peter, I don't mean to keep cutting you off, but we only have a few minutes left, and there's a lot that I want to get to. How do you think about grocery delivery as it has increased during the pandemic? I mean, have you had to make changes to the way that you are allocating or at least selling to different types of grocery stores, brick and mortar versus the large players in delivery like Amazon-owned Whole Foods?
Yeah, we've always been big at Amazon, Tim. We're share leader with our yogurts there and now oat milks. So it has not fundamentally changed. And most of the brick and mortars, whether it's Walmart or Target or even ShopRite here locally, or Stop and Shop, I'm not sure what the local is, also deliver. Mm-hmm. So they're brick and mortar, but they're also they're not pure play online, but they're brick and mortar, and they have online components, and so they're doing delivery, and we get our fair share of that. So we haven't had to fundamentally change our playbook on that to take advantage of, you know, that trend.
Let's talk labor and employees, because we got the jobs report last week that was a shock to many, many people. 266,000 jobs added versus expectations from economists for a million new jobs. There's tension between attracting employees because these jobs are available, as we learned from the JOLTS data earlier this week, but people are not necessarily going to those jobs. Mm-hmm. Are you having a hard time attracting employees right now?
We are faring better, Tim, but the labor market is tight, and I don't want to say we're immune. We're faring better, and I really think it's fundamentally, Tim, from what we just discussed in the last segment, which is we took care of our employees through the pandemic, and they are that pays off over time. I mean, not, you know, it's an investment, not an expense, and doing the right thing is good for business, and so our retention rates are quite high. So we haven't had high attrition. That's the first piece. The second piece, the brand's pretty exciting, and we're breaking into new categories, and we're liked as a company. So our recruitment has been in good shape. It's been quite effective. But it's not what it used to be. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we're completely insulated. We're just faring better.
Well, to that point, when you do find you lose employees, where do they go?
Yeah, a myriad of places. There's more options, Tim. And like I said, our attrition is very low. But when people do leave, there are, first of all, when you look at the federal programs and the state programs, that all rolls up to about $19 an hour, close to it, right, in New York. And I think that's what you're getting at. That's hard to compete with, if you think about it. But look, because the economy is so hot, there's a lot of building going on here. So, you know, could lose people to construction jobs and, you know, landscaping jobs that have more flex hours. There are a lot of distribution centers being built, new factories being built. There's just more competition. And it hasn't been an issue for us yet. And I think that's because of what we've been a very employee-centric company from the beginning, and we took care of our people. And like I said, throughout the pandemic, we've given special bonuses and childcare subsidies. Those are still in place. So all those things that we did in the pandemic have come to play now in terms of our low attrition and high retention.
Peter McGinnis, we are going to have to leave it there. It was really great to reconnect with you. Thanks so much for taking the time and for joining us on Bloomberg Business Week Radio. Peter McGinnis is President and Chief Operating Officer at Chobani. He joined us today on the phone from here in New York City.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it's Friday, just before 5 p.m., so the perfect time to enjoy a glass of wine, or at least talk about wine. And that's going to be with Terry Wheatley, president of Vintage Wine Estates. She joins us on the phone from Sonoma, California. Vintage Wine Estates has a portfolio of wines and spirits from wineries throughout Napa, Sonoma, Oregon, and Washington, and also California's Central Coast, which is where I'm from. So this is particularly special for me. Terry, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about the wine business right now, because Vintage Wine Estates is set to IPO later this month. Mm-hmm. Why is now the right time to IPO?
Well, you know, why go public now? I would say many of the wine companies have really suffered during the pandemic with their tasting rooms closed, which is a great source, primary source of wine club signups. Their on-premise business closed across the country. So we are entering an unprecedented time of opportunity for acquisitions. Hmm. So for us to access the public market, it just made sense for us to get that firepower and capital to go out and continue our track record of acquisitions. So we've done 20 acquisitions in the last 10 years. So we're looking to do 20 more in the next 10. If 20, not more.
20 or more in the next decade. That's a large number. I'm wondering, and then this is, you're planning to raise $690 million in the IPO. Are there certain regions that you're looking at? Are there certain types of wineries? Are there certain types of mm-hmm. spirits? What's appealing to you from an acquisition perspective right now?
Well, we will not acquire a spirit company. We will be looking in the wine space. Primarily California. We do look at Washington and Oregon. If you're from the Central Coast, that's really attractive to us. We have you might be familiar with the Leticia Winery here in San Luis Obispo.
Yep, that's where I'm from.
Oh my gosh, that's great. Well, that winery has been a tremendous purchase for us and continues to do really well. So that type of acquisition wineries, we really play in that $10 to $20 retail sweet spot. We'll probably acquire there. We may step it up a little bit. Maybe it'll go into $25, $30 a bottle at retail, but really focused on California, Washington, Oregon. You won't see us buying international properties or things on the East Coast or Texas or any place else. Really focused on the West
Coast. So, Terry, when you do buy a winery such as Leticia and you do incorporate it into the Vintage Wine Estates portfolio, what are the changes mm-hmm. that you bring, that you make to increase efficiencies, to make the acquisition make sense?
Well, for Leticia, the great thing about the way we purchase maybe up against other people in our peer group is that we try to keep the infrastructure the same. So the winemaker, Eric Hickey, is still the winemaker there. His father was actually the winemaker previous to him. But we infuse capital we just put in some additional production capability there. We're improving the vineyards, just increased capital. We're working on, as you probably know, driving into Leticia is a little interesting. So we're working on a new entrance and how you get out of the property. So again, it's capital. We go in and we take out the redundancy. So we bring in their financial, all their finance teams and stuff. We incorporate that. So the back office, we really try to incorporate that into the Vintage Wine Estates headquarters. But besides that, we try to keep these wineries individual with individual personalities, and it's really worked for us. So I'm so pleased that you're so familiar with Leticia.
Yeah, among many other, you drive there these days in California Central Coast, and it's just vineyards as far as the eye can see, which raises the question just about climate change and water, because that's something that mm-hmm. many areas of California struggle with. How do you think about a natural resource like water and that it is, in fact, it's always a drought?
Well, not always.
It
feels like it. We're in a drought right now, which makes for interesting farming, but where we can, we dry farm. We are always looking at water conservation, recycling, and so forth. We do that with the energy, our production plant up in Hopland. We have solar, so we try to make our entire facility there supported by our solar panels. So we really do have an eye on sustainability for, our vineyards with water conservation and so forth. So it's top of mind in everything that we do. But, you know, we are in California. We are in the farming heartlands. And so that is always a concern. But if you're constantly working on how you protect the water resources, mm-hmm. we feel like that we have a good plan in place.
Terry, you mentioned the way that the tasting rooms and actually on-premise just took a hit mm-hmm. during the pandemic, and how wine clubs were really affected because tasting rooms are such a big part of how people actually learn about wines. Mm-hmm. What adjustments did you guys make to your portfolio of brands at Vintage Wine Estates? How did mm-hmm. you get through the pandemic?
Well, you know, unlike other wineries in our peer group, we actually grew during the pandemic in our direct-to-consumer business. So we are lucky that we're diversified, and we have 14 tasting rooms. Again, that really feeds our 19 wine clubs. Hmm. But we have an e-commerce email list of over 850,000 people. We mined that e-commerce list during the pandemic. We own the Cameron Hughes brand. We believe that's the largest digitally native wine brand out there. That really grew during the pandemic. We have a telesales group that is selling over right. the telephone. Yes, people still do that, but the Windsor wine brand, where you do right. custom labels and people shop that. And last but not least, we do probably 90% of the wines that are sold on QVC. That business just went through the roof. So we had multiple levers right. that we could pull to grow during the pandemic, unlike other people in the wine space.
Terry Wheatley is president of Vintage Wine Estates, joining us on the phone from Sonoma, California. Terry, thanks so much for taking the time.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.